You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review on Monocle 24, and I'm Matt Alagaya. This week, I'm joined by author and critic Mark Mason, who's putting his love of facts to good use by talking us through some of May's best non-fiction releases. We'll hear the extraordinary story of discovering a very ordinary character in Alexander Master's new biography, A Life Discarded. We'll see if paperback writer Philip Norman can lift the lid on the life of Paul McCartney in the first biography to be granted the musician's permission and access to his family and friends. And we'll find out what it's like to be an artist's model in Kelly Swain's memoir, The Naked Muse. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. If you found A Stranger's Diary in a skip, would you read it? What if you found over 100 volumes all written by the same hand? Well, that's exactly what happened to British biographer Alexander Masters in his hometown of Cambridge. After years of sitting on the bounty, he eventually set about piecing together the life of this mystery writer, and the resulting book was A Life Discarded. Mark, welcome to the show. Now, this is a pretty extraordinary story, isn't it? I mean, what did Masters discover as he sort of began reading these enormous diary entries?
Not very much to start with. What makes the beginning interesting is the first half of the book, really, is he deliberately doesn't find out too much because he likes the mystery. And he says that the anonymity, at first he can't even work out, because of course when you write a diary you just write I, you don't give any clues to yourself. He can't work out for the first few times he looks into them whether it's a man or a woman. And he thinks it must be a man because it's beautifully written lots of this book. This is an example of that. He says there was a destructive element about the way the writing filled up the page, like a boy stamping on fresh snow. You know, the pages are completely filled. Every little bit of space is used. And then he finds out it's a woman. There's a constant reference to whiters, the word white with RS on the end. He just assumes that it's a man that she's in love with. And only after a few references to it does he realise it's actually a house called Whitefield that she was very fond of, and then there's a further secret behind that as to why she's fond of the house. And so for a lot of it, he says, one of the quotes is, the great excitement of an anonymous diary is that it might belong to anybody. Even giving I a name destroyed a vital thing that made the books interesting, a sense of quiet universality. Right. And he doesn't want to find out too much about them. He dreads that it's going to be someone famous. Was, you know, Cambridge, it could have been a famous academic. And so for a lot of it, he deliberately scuppers it, and he goes along to a graphologist, and he goes off on sidetracks. He gets sidetracked by what the graphologist tells him.
So this is very much a book about him discovering what's in these diaries, more than about the person. Do we get long diary entries written out?
Not
verbatim?
Long, no, you'll get a paragraph at a time, that's about it. And there's a few illustrations in there to illustrate the handwriting. But gradually, sort of, the clues do come out. He finds out she's a woman, she's called Laura. For ages, she's called Not Mary, because the only clue he's had is that someone at a party couldn't remember her name. Said, are you Mary? And she said, no, I'm not. So then he knows what her name isn't. But he finds out she's Laura. She's born in 1939. Her first memory is of watching, quote, a solitary German plane fly over the village and drop a bomb on a house flying the Union Jack. And he knows roughly where she was brought up. But a lot of it is about other people in her life. She, early on, got to be careful how I phrase this, that I don't give too much away,
because it's
a bit,
yeah.
It's a bit like a novelist. I'd feel guilty if I spoilt it too much for the author. But there's someone called E who keeps bullying Laura. E said I was stupid. E said I was weak in every way. And Laura's relationship with E is very complex. And then he discovers more about E. And there's someone else that has a sort of similar relationship. And then there's someone in the 1970s who she's a live-in housekeeper at some point. For this guy called Peter, who's evil, and she dreams of throttling him. And there's a lot of black comedy in there. She has a boil-in-the-bag chicken curry that's, quote, so corrosive that when she's not eating it, she uses it to clean egg off the saucepan. And it's sort of a bit like, kept reminding me of Diary of a Nobody, that this had to be about someone with, in ways, quite a mundane life, that they didn't become famous, they didn't go off and achieve anything, and that's one of the sadnesses.
I was going to say, because there's a bit of a sort of tragic element here where, I mean, Laura, at the beginning of the book, she seems to have great plans for her life. She wants to be a well-known artist, you know. And these things, I mean, without giving too much away, these things don't come true.
No, and that ends up being the story. And there's a brilliant quote about her, as he can see, because he's reading her diary, what she herself never saw, because it was happening to her day by day, which is, as a young woman, she was a good writer. but diary entries about not exploiting her talent gobbled up the time she had to develop her talent. Writing destroyed her writing. And she dreams of her diaries being read, and of course they are. And there's a brilliant twist at the end that it would be very unfair to give away. But it's almost like a, you know, a couple of points I got very suspicious. I thought, is this a hoax? Has he made this up? This is just too good. But it's not in the end, and you know, he proves that it's not, and it's sort of a thriller that not very much happens in. And a lot of it's about him as about her, because he sees a lot of similarities with his own personality in her. And it's a very good detective story and really well written.
And someone has described it as she's the most prolific diary writer in sort of known history. Is that fair? Can we say that?
I mean, she...
It is a lot of writing.
He works out that the diaries that he's got, 148 volumes, have got 5 million words in. And then, because for ages he won't put them in chronological order because that would make too much sense of it and it would be, you know, ruining the not discovering it thing. But then he realises the gap's in, and assuming that she's kept up the same rate throughout her life, she's written 40 million words. So yeah, Amazing. It's a very prolific, very, in it, like I say, very mundane. The phrase he keeps using is a very extraordinary, ordinary woman.
A Life Discarded by Alexander Masters is out now, published by Fourth Estate. We turn now to the latest biography of Beatles frontman Paul McCartney. Much has been written about McCartney in the past, but this is the first biography to be published with his permission and with access to close family and friends. It's written by Philip Norman, who's authored plenty of books on the Beatles and its members, amongst other big-name musicians. Mark, what does all this access offer us that we might not have known before this?
Some great facts, some great trivia. I thought I knew a lot about the Beatles, but he explains, a brilliant introduction. Philip Norman explains that he wrote a book, it was published in 1981, called Shout, which was a biography of the Beatles. And McCartney hated it because it was one of the early books that put forward the John was the really cool avant-garde, you know, out there edgy one, and Paul was the safe commercial pappy pleasing the housewives with the silly love songs things, which understandably McCartney hates because it's just not true. And some of the book is Philip Norman demolishing that. As McCartney says, he was into Stockhausen, he funded International Times, the underground newspaper in the 60s, and this is McCartney's own quote, while John was living on a golf course in bloody Weybridge, which is, you know, he had the most stockbroker, mundane, you know, conventional life. It adds a great little facts that he could only have got from McCartney's friends and from family and people who've cooperated. There's a brilliant story about him living with Jane Asher, which is when it first got mental, when Beatlemania first, it just became impossible for them to move. And he was living on Wimpole Street, not very far from the studio, a couple of blocks away. And Jane Asher's father had this huge house on Wimpole Street, big five-story. And McCartney's bedroom was at the top. It was back in the 1960s, and he couldn't sleep in the same room as Jane Asher, even though they were boyfriend and girlfriend. He had a room at the top, and of course the Beatles fans used to absolutely camp out on the pavement and make it impossible for anyone to move. So McCartney had an arrangement with the next-door neighbour that they worked out he could edge along, very dangerously, edge along a little parapet at the back of the building, down through one house and out through the Muse house at the back that went out to the parallel street. The old couple who had the Muse house were happy for him to do that and didn't ever ask for any money or anything. But one day McCartney noticed that they didn't have a fridge, and so he bought them one. He just had one delivered to them to say thank you. There's, you know, really sweet stories in there and brilliant details about what it must be like to be either Paul McCartney or John Lennon. John Lennon used to get annoyed when he walked into the New York Plaza Hotel, just down the street from where he lived at Central Park, and went into the Palm Court Cafe there, and he was going for a cup of tea. The string quartet that played there would start playing Yesterday, which famously was Paul McCartney's, absolutely nothing to do with John Lennon, and it used to wind Lennon up no end. A few decades later, Paul McCartney's there with his iPad. Again, this is something he could only have got from a friend of McCartney. McCartney didn't cooperate personally, but he let people pass things on. McCartney's iPad, because of the space constraint, renders the song Hey Jude as Hey Jude by John Lennon and ... because there's no room for Paul McCartney. And, you know, but again, McCartney wrote Hey Jude himself, nothing to do with Lennon. There's lots of great stuff like that. But also, he really tackles the character.
Paul McCartney, the biography by Philip Norman, is out now, published by Weidenfield and Nicholson. Our final book today is rather stripped back. It's a short book at just 160 pages, and it explores author Kelly Swain's previous life as an artist's model. In The Naked Muse, Swain meditates on art, travel, and our acceptance of our own bodies. Mark, it's not often that you hear the voice of a life model. What insights does Swain offer us in this book?
lots on lots of different levels. I hate to sound like an art critic, but on lots of different levels. The very ordinary stuff about just what it's like. And she says, yes, it is very difficult to stay still for that long. She said, you know, you try sitting still, she says, just try it. After 5 minutes, are you okay? Then try 40 minutes without scratching. You know, she talks about you get a scratch on the back of the neck and all that sort of stuff. And I was really, you get to like her because she seems a very likable person, very conscientious about her work, that some models she knows will enforce strict time limits and will say, right, I'm only going to sit still 15 minutes at a time, then we have to have a break. But she will sit there for as long as it takes. And she just wants to be a good, you know, she wants to provide a good service. So she's obviously very conscientious. You like her from the start. And then she's got lots of sort of insights from history. Like Marina Warner said, every portrait that is painted with feeling is a portrait of the artist, not of the sitter. Kelly Swain says that's how she's found it herself. She'll look at when a group have all done a portrait of her, she will see the painter in rather than herself. In, you know, you can see that each portrait is different. And people with big eyes paint her with bigger eyes. When a man paints her rather than a woman, she looks slightly more masculine, she thinks.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then great stuff about quotes about just what it's like, you know, to do that, to not have your clothes on for a living, if you like. The Marilyn Monroe quote, there's one of Marilyn Monroe's nude pictures. She said, it's not true that I had nothing on. I had the radio on.
So she goes through the kind of nuts and bolts of how, you know, how difficult it is to sit still and how you have your scratches and things. Does she go from there to talking about philosophy? I mean, where does she go from there? It must, you know, 160 pages, she must cover a bit more than that, I would expect.
Yeah, and it's really interesting on what she finds. There's lots about art, like I say, about how the painter comes through as well as the subject of the portrait. But also things like, it's really intriguing that her eyesight is not perfect. And if she's found that if she poses with her contact lenses in and she can see everything more clearly, she feels slightly more uneasy and it's not just a completely relaxing thing. And then the thing that surprised me most was she's done portrait sitting where she's clothed and they're painting her face, rather than nude modelling where they're painting the whole body. And she said she finds that more, I can't remember the word she used, but it's something like more personal. The fact that they will come very close up and look at her face and look at her eyes. And that's slightly more intimidating, she says, than being naked in front of a room full, where she never makes eye contact because it would be unfair on both people. She'd start to feel a bit self-conscious and probably the painter would as well. So she fixes a gaze somewhere on the ceiling, on the wall, or sometimes she's made marks on the wall before the session just so that she's got something to look at. And then she finds herself, if it's a big warehouse studio sort of thing, she'll imagine it as a warehouse, as a studio flat, and she'll imagine what curtain she'd have where, and that's how she passes her time.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
And did she find it kind of liberating to take her clothes off and be a life model? I mean, is there something about, you know, accepting her own body through this?
Yeah, she's not so much of that, actually. I don't think she'd got any insecurities to start with. And she says all the way through it, she's aware, you know, she knows she's attractive. You know, she's had boyfriends and she's been married and she's never had a problem with self-image. It's really interesting actually talking what other people think of the female body, in that a lot of painters say they much prefer an older, less good-looking, less physically perfect model because it's more interesting, you know. More curves, more flabby, more, you know, more blotches on the skin, all those things that you think are normally not to be sought after. If you're a portrait painter, they're sort of stuff to work with.
The Naked Muse by Kelly Swain comes out on the 26th of May, published by Valley Press. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Mark Mason. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll be reviewing a few more flicks from this year's Cannes Film Festival. But for now, goodbye from me and thanks very much for listening.